Hey everybody, we're back and we're talking about groundwater, which is number two here. So in the last lecture, I should have been talking about soil, right? Both soil and clay, mudstone. And you know, a lot of what we've been discussing is how minerals are concentrated in the earth naturally so that they get to a point where they become an ore, right? An ore deposit, once again, is a deposit that is economic to mine. Okay, you have enough concentration of whatever it is you're interested in, whether it's lithium, which we've talked about, copper, we've talked a little bit about, and now we've talked about various clays like kaolinite, bentonite, diatomite, etc. Regardless, the earth is concentrating these different materials through various processes, right? And we're going to go and find where they're concentrated because that's where they're economic. That's where they are ore. That's O-R-E, right? Ore. And groundwater is a really important player in this whole process of concentrating minerals. And so we're going to talk about groundwater today. We're going to talk about it a lot throughout the course, so this isn't the first time we'll be discussing it. And I'm actually going to kind of introduce it by speaking to some of the water resource issues around groundwater. So groundwater is something that does concentrate minerals by, and I've mentioned this, by dissolving and reprecipitating dissolved solids. So it'll dissolve a whole bunch of stuff, and then it'll start precipitating out just certain minerals, right? Concentrating them effectively in certain locations based on the pressure and temperature conditions of that entire circulation. But we need to understand what groundwater is. I think a lot of people, when they hear the word groundwater, they kind of think of this underground cave that's just full of water. Okay, that can happen, actually. We do have caves. We call those karst systems. That's K-A-R-S-T. Those do exist, and in some cases, they have water in them. But the vast majority of groundwater that we're talking about when we talk about groundwater, okay, whether it's for agricultural uses, whether it's for municipalities and drinking water, et cetera, that groundwater is actually generally not going to be in big caves and caverns. It's going to be in the pore space, right, within the rock that's in the subsurface, and we'll discuss what that looks like. So we're going to talk about groundwater today, but let's go ahead and move on into, yes, the next slide, which is going to be permeability. Okay, so permeability is something that we care about, and I mentioned that there's two things here, and there's two terms that I want you to take away from this class regarding groundwater. This applies to groundwater, applies to any fluid in the subsurface, right? Permeability is one of them, and porosity is the other. We're going to talk about porosity in just a moment. But permeability, okay, is a measure of the ability of fluid to flow and move through the rock. Okay, how permeable is that rock? Okay, you can think about it in terms of a filter, right? A coffee filter, for example. Coffee filters come with different mesh sizes, right? And depending on the mesh size, it's either going to let small particulate matter come through or it's not, okay? And so depending on how finely you grind your coffee, right, that may determine the mesh size that you can use in your filter when you're actually, whether it's drip coffee or whatnot. Okay, and so that's ultimately what we're talking about here in terms of permeability, right? There needs to be a pathway for that fluid to move. And sometimes that pathway is really small, okay? And that's going to affect the ability of that fluid to move through it. In this case, we're talking about water, groundwater. In other cases, the pathways may be large, and so you can get very large movement of groundwater through that system. And different rock types have different permeabilities, okay, or the ability of fluid to flow through that rock, different permeabilities. So, for example, if we're talking about gravel here at the upper end, okay, gravel has a very high permeability, which is measured in this term K here. You can see it gets larger as we go to the right. Okay, gravel, high permeability, sand. I've mentioned sand quite a few times, and this is hopefully pretty intuitive. If you go to the beach and the waves come up, right, that water, it doesn't just sit on the surface of the sand, okay? It very quickly infiltrates into the sand because that sand is very permeable. Okay, vesicular basalt. What's that? Well, it's basalt is a lava rock, and we have tons of it in Oregon. It's all over the place. Vesicular basalt means it has, it's a lava rock with lots of vesicles, and vesicles are just little air pockets that exists within that basalt. And if you have all these little air pockets, and this is because it was somewhat frothy, sort of like if you, you know, have a fizzy drink or a beer or something, and you can have some foam up on the top there. There's some amount of froth or gas that exists in that lava when it erupts. And so you end up with these little vesicles in there that hold that gas. And if you have enough of those, that creates pathways for fluid, right? Permeability. Huge range there, right? Because sometimes those vesicles, which can hold fluids, are connected, and sometimes they aren't. If they're connected, the permeability is going to be high. If they aren't, it's going to be low. Okay, silt, which I mentioned, is a type of mud. Okay, so mudstone or siltstone, generally lower permeability than sand. Okay, volcanic tuff, that's ash. It's ultimately in a volcanic eruption, a lot of ash comes out, right? It gets deposited on the ground, and that stuff is real fluffy and whatnot. But if it ends up getting buried, it can form a tuff, which is a rock, and that tuff can have a pretty wide range of permeabilities also. Limestone, kind of all over the place. Limestone is where you find caves, karst. And limestone is very unpredictable in terms of its permeability and its porosity, to be honest, in that it requires dissolution. It requires it to be dissolved to some degree to create those flow pathways moving through it. Okay, so that's limestone. On to clay and shale. So silt, notice, is a mudstone. Clay and shale are also mudstones. I don't know if you remember, I mentioned this in the previous lecture, I believe, that clay, even though it's also a mud, the difference between it and silt, do you remember? It might be intuitive in terms of how these are popping out on the permeability graph as well, right? Clay and shale are going to be less permeable than silt, and that's because the difference is grain size, okay? They're both muds in that they both have grain sizes that are smaller than sand. That's basically what a mud is. Grain size is smaller than sand. But within that fraction of mud, okay, silt is a little bit coarser grained and clay is a little bit finer grain. Okay, so the finer grain material, less permeable. And then we have igneous and metamorphic rocks generally, which are going to be lava rocks, things like granite. And then metamorphic rocks are rocks that are changing. So you can get any type of rock, whether it's sedimentary or a granite or something that then gets heated up, it'll start changing into a new rock. And those would be things like schist or gneiss. There's a lot of different types of metamorphic rocks out there. But those are going to be more crystalline generally, okay? And if you have crystalline rocks where the crystals are all packed together and have grown together, you just don't have much porosity generally and you don't have much permeability. Okay, so that's kind of the lowest end. This is important, okay, in thinking about where are our water resources, right? When we're talking about groundwater, what's it going to be in? It's probably not going to be in an igneous or in a metamorphic rock. So you go to the Sierra Nevada, which is primarily this granite batholith, right? This huge, just massive granite out there. If you've been to Yosemite or anything like that, you see it's really beautiful, you know, huge rocks and such, but that's all granite. There is not much room for water in that rock. Okay, so if you went down into the subsurface, you're not going to find a big aquifer down there in granite because it just can't hold much water. However, if you go out into the Great Valley right next door, right, the San Joaquin Valley in Southern California or any part of the Great Valley of California there, the breadbasket, right, of California, you get a lot of agriculture. That's a basin. So you have sedimentary rocks underneath your feet, things like sands, gravels, okay, even muds, silts, and in some cases clays. So in that case, yes, you do have quite a bit of reservoir rock, which is the type of rock that's going to hold water and create an aquifer. Okay, that affects permeability. Rock type matters. All right, let's move on. So this is sort of a generalized image, which just gives you a sense of what's happening in some of these systems. And it's a little bit more complicated than I prefer. But it does come from the text, and it sort of describes different parts of the groundwater system and some of the things you could encounter. So in the highlands here, let's start up there, you have precipitation, right? And that precipitation hits the ground, and what does it do? Well, it infiltrates in through the soil column. And depending on the rock and the subsurface, right, it's either going to flow into that rock or it's not. It depends on how permeable it is. If it's a bunch of granite, it's probably not going to go into it, at least very readily, right? On the other hand, if you got sandstone, like is shown here, see confined sandstone aquifer. Okay, if you got a layer of sandstone here that intercepts the surface up where you get a bunch of rainfall, Okay, that water is actually going to infiltrate into that sandstone unit, and that's going to become an aquifer. Okay, on the other hand, we have the shale in here that exists just above that sandstone unit. That shale is relatively impermeable, right? It doesn't transmit fluid well, so it acts as a sealing layer, kind of like the edge of your container in a way. You think of the sandstone as being your container, like your bowl or your water bottle, okay? And then the edges of that water bottle, the plastic that holds the water, where you can't really have water moving in and out of it, sort of the edges of that container being this shale on the top, and then below, you can see we have impermeable basement rock. And that oftentimes could be a metamorphic rock or an igneous rock, like we saw in the previous slide, these ones that have very low permeability. Okay, and then you can see where groundwater exists. So if this is the surface, right, where my arrow is going here, that's sort of the topography of the landscape. You have a little lake right here that exists, and that lake is charging the groundwater here in the subsurface. So there is pore space in this rock, okay, and that pore space is being filled up with water that's being charged from, again, precipitation that falls, maybe collects into a lake, and then that lake water infiltrates into the subsurface, feeding a groundwater system. You could have, you know, wells that are drilled and producing some of that groundwater and being used for all sorts of things. Okay, there's, let's see, what else do we want to talk about here? Well, I think that might be good. The other thing that I'll just mention is that as you go out, you know, into sort of the more distant parts of the system here, you eventually come across the ocean, right? And so when you're near the coast, that is one issue that you have to be aware of, is the interaction between seawater, which is also infiltrating the subsurface, okay? That's filling the pore space of rocks in the subsurface, of reservoir rocks that have porosity and permeability. Okay, and there's an interaction, right, between that seawater, which is saline and not so good for drinking, and freshwater right here. And there's going to be a transition zone that exists in coastal areas. And that can be an issue, right, depending on where your population center is. You know, everybody needs access to fresh water. And, you know, that can be difficult depending on how much your salt water is influencing the groundwater underneath your feet. Okay. One issue would be is if I, you know, drill a bunch of wells into my freshwater aquifer here. Okay. And I start pulling that water out. Okay. I'm creating a negative pressure gradient. I'm lowering the pressure in this area. And what's that going to do? That's going to draw in water from the surrounding areas. And if it's near where my salt water is, right, then that could pull that salt water in towards the well, and eventually it could break through. In other words, it could come and start feeding into my well. At that point, my well is kind of useless, you know, or maybe it starts pulling it towards my neighbor's well. You can see this can become somewhat contentious. So this is just a nice generalized map, again, that shows these systems basically. I think it's a good sort of thing to reference. Okay. Where do aquifers exist throughout the world? Well, this is from the major textbook, Minerals. It's back there somewhere. This is from the main textbook that we're using in the class, the Kessler and Simon book. And you can see we have aquifers throughout the world. Okay, in the United States, let's sort of focus on that for a minute. You can see in the Midwest, we have this guy. This is the Ogallala aquifer, a very large one. And we also have an aquifer that exists throughout the Southwest and just kind of in the Western United States in general. You can see there's also some in California, in the Great Valley here, a little bit up in Canada, South America, etc. All throughout the world, you have aquifers, groundwater resources that are being used. And you have to kind of pay attention to these resources because they're very important, but they can also be contaminated. They can also have toxic substances in them, such as arsenic, such as fluorine. Okay, so fluoride is something that, you know, your dentist might tell you that you want a little bit of to keep your teeth strong. Well, that's true. You know, that is something that a lot of people end up wanting. In Oregon, in Portland, we don't have fluoride in our drinking water. Some places do. Some people actually put it in there on purpose for health reasons. Other people are like, no, we don't want that. Other municipalities, Portland, we don't. But people will regardless maybe use mouthwash or something in order to try to get fluoride because, you know, a lot of dentists will say it's good for your teeth. Well, you can also have too much fluoride, Okay, you can have too much fluorine and it can become toxic. It can start causing health problems. And in some parts of the world, groundwater resources do have too much fluorine dissolved in the groundwater. And that is a problem. That's a health problem. And you can see it's sort of where you have these hash marks coming across. So in parts of Africa here, this is way up in Siberia, there's an area here, South America. It does exist a little bit even in the United States. So it's something you got to pay attention to. And why does that happen? Well, it's generally going to be occurring where the groundwater is old. Okay, so it's relatively evolved. It's been sitting down there in the rock for a long time, so it's had a chance to interact with the rock and dissolve certain elements from the rock. Okay, it becomes more concentrated in some of these elements like fluorine. That's part of it. And it also has to do with the type of rock that it's interacting with. If you're interacting with something that's more what we would call acidic or felsic, okay, that just means it's a rock that has more silica in it, basically. You would end up having higher potential, at least for higher amounts of fluorine. And so that would be something like a granite or certain types of sandstones, you know, what we would call a really clean sandstone, especially if that water's, again, old and been sitting in it for a long time, you could end up with too much fluorine. So that's something to be aware of. But yes, aquifers exist all over the world, and they're very important resources. And we're going to look at some of these in more detail. So why do they exist in the Western United States, you know, considering it's so dry? Well, one thing that I was pointing out that we have quite a bit of groundwater, you know, throughout parts of Nevada, California, and the Great Basin over here, which isn't really shown. But you have groundwater throughout the Southwest. This area is relatively dry today. So where's the groundwater coming from? Well, in a lot of cases, it's very old. Okay, and we would call this, you know, ice age in many cases, groundwater. Groundwater that was charged or that flowed into the subsurface, you know, over 10,000 years ago. Okay, and during the last ice age, which we would call the last glacial maximum, okay, about 15 to 25,000 years ago, the climate in the western U.S. was very different. And this is a map that shows different, excuse me, different lakes, Pleistocene lakes, along with present day lakes. Okay, so this lighter color is present day, and the darker blue is Pleistocene. And Pleistocene is sort of just referring to these glacial lakes. So these lakes that existed during the last glacial maximum, when we had an ice sheet that had extended down from Canada into the upper part of the United States. Climate was very different. You had a lot of water in this area. And you can see how large some of these lakes were at that time, okay? And they have different names, even up in Oregon, right? Remember I showed a picture in the last lecture of the Alvor Desert? That's a playa, right? It's a dry lake bed, and it's in southeastern Oregon, which is where my cursor is here. And I was standing, or I took a picture at least, of two students on a field trip out there, and they're standing on a dry lake bed, mud cracks, etc. There is still a little bit of water that will go into that lake periodically, seasonally, during the wet part of the year. But it definitely doesn't fill up, right? Or rarely, shall we say, would it fill up. And it wouldn't be persistent right throughout the year. There's just not enough water falling. However, back during the last ice age, it was persistent. You had a lot of water in that lake. Right here, you can see this sort of dark blue outline, in addition to many others throughout the area. This is Malheur Lake. So Burns, Oregon would be kind of on the north side of this. I mean, this thing was massive. You had a lot of water, okay, in these areas that are currently very dry, right, very deserty. Actually, we looked at a picture of the Black Rock Desert, which would be up here in northwestern Nevada, you know, filled with water. And so when all this water is there, like I showed in the last picture, you have these lakes and such, that water is infiltrating slowly into the subsurface, and it's charging these groundwater aquifers, okay? It's filling them up. And so, you know, that water, it gets charged in the aquifer, and then it just sits there for thousands of years until we start drilling a bunch of wells in there and pumping it out. Okay, so that water now in the Southwest, which is currently clearly very dry, it's a desert, that water that's in the subsurface is groundwater that was charged back during the Ice Age primarily. I mean, there is still some charging that happens today because there are rivers that run through the area, etc. But a lot of it is this Pleistocene or Ice Age water, okay? And so you think about it. What you're using there is probably not being recharged, at least at a very fast rate, right? And it won't be again until our next Ice Age, which Which will come eventually, right? The Earth just sort of periodically goes through these cycles, and we will eventually come into another ice age, but it's thousands of years away. Okay, well, let's continue on to talking a little bit about these two concepts I already mentioned, porosity and permeability. So if this was a sandstone, we have lots of different grains of sand that are shown. Okay, and I have kind of a spectrum of different degrees of porosity and permeability shown here. Okay, so let's start with the middle one. Okay, I have pore space that exists between my grains. Okay, this is where my water is in an aquifer, right? It's between grains within this sandstone, right? I have lots of pore spaces. So my porosity in this center section may be pretty good, right? However, in order for permeability, which is the ability for that water to move through the rock, in order for permeability to be good, these pore spaces have to be connected, right? So that water can move from one pore space to another and ultimately flow through the rock. So in this middle case, I have porosity. It's pretty reasonable, but my permeability is not so good. Okay, it's non-permeable. Porous, non-permeable. Okay, you can go to the left here, and in this case now we don't even have any porosity, right? We don't have porosity or permeability. Okay, that's a terrible reservoir rock. It's not going to hold much water at all. Okay, we aren't going to be using this particular rock in the subsurface for groundwater. Over here now we have the opposite end of the spectrum where we have a lot of pore space. And we also have a lot of permeability, okay? This pore space is connected, so the fluid here, in this case water, can flow. And in reality, it's not like these grains are going to be floating in water, okay? That's not what happens. That is actually kind of what happens during liquefaction, which is something that's just a near-surface phenomenon. But generally, these grains are always going to be touching, okay? And you got to remember, we're looking at a two-dimensional sort of profile view through a rock here. And this is, in reality, rock is three-dimensional, right? These grains are coming in and out of the screen. And so they are actually going to be touching other grains and being held together within sort of a grainy matrix. And even so, you can still have connected pore spaces, okay? And this is what it looks like in a non-cartoon version. So now we're looking at a microscopic, through a microscope, you look at a thin section of a sandstone, and you can see the sandstone reservoir rock is how it's being described here, 0.1 millimeters. So this is very high, this is fairly high magnification, right? The pore spaces in here, you could be occupied by anything you want. It could be oil, gas, water, whatever, any type of fluid, right? And the pore space is being shown now is blue. So this is what it looks like in reality, which is kind of interesting. See all these different grains here? Okay, these are all different grains, and it's a sandstone. So these are sand grains. Okay, it gives you a sense of kind of how big or how magnified this image is, right? All these little sand grains in here that are interconnected, right? They're supporting each other, but then you have pore space between them. And that pore space in this particular sandstone reservoir is relatively well connected in three dimensions. Okay, very interesting. I like seeing this sort of reality picture in addition to a cartoon, because reality is oftentimes messier, isn't it? But it's pretty cool. Okay, so what happens when you produce more groundwater than is entering back into the aquifer, right? When you have water that's going into the aquifer, we call that recharge. And you can classify that as a rate. It can be a recharge rate. And then you can also have a extraction rate, right? A pumping rate, a rate at which all the different people in the area, whether you're, you know, in Phoenix, Arizona, like this image, this is near Luke Air Force Base, which is in Phoenix. Whether you're in a location like this or wherever, you have all these wells that exist in the area and people are pumping out groundwater. Some of it's residential, but in all honesty, the vast majority is going to be agricultural. And what happens if everybody who's pumping is pumping at a rate that's higher than the rate at which recharge is occurring? So you're removing more water than is going in. Well, what's going to happen is that water is actually in the pore space. In many cases, it can be providing some support, right, for the rock. Okay, that's material that's in there. So when you move that, it actually allows the rock to start to compact more, right? Because that pore space is now filled with gas, air, or as opposed to water, which is going to have a little bit more strength, right? Water is close to being non-compressible. Okay, it doesn't compress. However, air is much more compressible. And so you think about this, as you remove that water, you actually get subsidence, right? As that reservoir compacts. As you remove the water, it compacts more and more, and you get subsidence. And this is a really dramatic example of it happening again in the Phoenix area. We've had a lot of pumping of groundwater in the Phoenix area for quite some time. This is near Luke Air Force Base. 5.5 meters in elevation change over 35 years. Pretty incredible. So 1957, literally the ground surface was way, way up here. Okay, and then over the, you know, decades, okay, coming down to 1991, you can imagine this much subsidence, right? That much subsidence is going to cause some deformation throughout the area, cracks and things like that, and it does. And I should note, actually, I think there's an image coming up here in just a moment that's going to show what's been happening in more recent decades, because, I mean, 1991, that's like 30-plus years ago. So what's been happening in recent decades, right? Phoenix has just gotten bigger. I mean, Phoenix has grown. It's a huge city. But once again, the key here is agriculture, because agriculture usage of groundwater is massive compared to generally, right, per capita compared to the human residential usage. Okay, so let's look at that a little bit more recently. So when we're talking about the water table, this is kind of like what we're talking about. This is a sort of image that shows, you know, an area below that dash line that's saturated, right? All the pore space filled with fluid, and above this dash line, you get some gas, air, and whatnot, some connate water that's just connected to the surface of the grains, right? But generally, okay. We've got all this area where there's no longer water in the pore spaces. So this is where your water table is, okay? And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about drawing down an aquifer, is the movement of the water table here, okay? Sometimes you have to make your wells deeper because the water table may fall below the bottom of your well. So you got to go in there and re-drill it to a deeper level. That also is happens sometimes. Okay, and then we also have, I should probably turn off, I'm going to turn off my... image just for a second here. Okay, and then over here, we're looking at groundwater level change. So now this is groundwater level, not the actual surface level like we were looking at in the previous slide, right? This is now the water table level, this dashed line, okay? And this is for Phoenix and then also for Tucson here. And now we're getting into more recent times from 2002 up to 2018, and what is happening? Well, let's start with Phoenix. It's actually, you know, these are different wells, right? Well 1, 2, and 3. It's actually pretty flat, okay? Especially well 2. It hasn't really changed much. It went down a little bit, then popped back up. Well 3, also kind of similar. Well 1 actually has increased quite a bit. This is meters, 10 meters, 20 meters. Okay, the water level increased quite a bit and then went back down. So, in general, right, the Phoenix area is not seeing those levels, at least water table level drawdown, like we saw likely back when you had all that subsidence, surface subsidence. In Tucson, look, it's pretty remarkable. We go from, these are four different wells, and we have levels that are almost uniformly, you can see at least wells 1 through 3, are uniformly increasing, starting maybe somewhere around 2008. Okay, increasing in their water level up through 2018. And the increase is significant. That's 5, 10, that's 10 meters or so, okay, of increase, 30 feet, right, of an increase in the water table. Okay, that means that more water is going into that aquifer than is being drawn down. And that's a good thing. So why is that happening? Okay, we're going to talk about that just a little bit here. Ultimately, yeah, there's something called the Central Arizona Project. I was trying to remember what that phrase was exactly. The Central Arizona Project, it was a canal that was built and has been used to divert water from the Colorado River, which we're going to be talking about here, to both Phoenix and Tucson. And it started in 1985, actually, so some time ago, just before that previous image that we saw from 1991. And then also in 2001. So in other words, a significant diversion of the Colorado River towards the Phoenix and Tucson area started just 1 year before this graph shows data. Okay, and what did that do? Well, the reliance on groundwater resources for these two cities went down significantly, right? Because now they have another source of water that they're able to use, whether it's for agriculture, residential, industrial, et cetera. And so it's just less reliance on groundwater. Before that, it was pretty much groundwater was their main source. And now they've been able to reduce that reliance quite a bit and stabilize the water tables. One of the things that I want to want people to explore a little bit, and I posted an article about this online, and it talks about water usage ultimately and water rights between California and Arizona, and how contentious it can be, and how big of an issue it can be for the economies of those two states. Okay, and that's one of the reasons why it ends up being so contentious, right? Because there are economics involved here, and it's always something that is being debated. It's always something that's being fought over. When you get into these arid areas, we see it in Central Oregon as well, where it's relatively arid, these become very contentious political issues, and people will throw a lot of money at trying to acquire or retain water rights in these places. So it's pretty interesting. Speaking of the Colorado, let's talk about that just a little bit here. So this is an image here of California now, and it's showing various aqueducts that are bringing water to Los Angeles. Okay, Los Angeles is kind of the beast in this story of being very water hungry, right? They have a huge water need. It's such a massive city, and they definitely don't have nearly enough water locally to supply the demand, so they have to bring in water from elsewhere, including the Colorado River, right? The Colorado River Aqueduct. So they're taking a certain amount out this way. Phoenix and Tucson are diverting through that, the Central Arizona project. They're diverting through a canal out this direction towards Phoenix and Tucson. That Colorado River, it is taxed and it is key. In addition, Los Angeles is pulling water from the Great Valley, the California Water Aqueduct. And you see this if you take I-5 between Los Angeles and San Francisco. You will drive by, this is San Francisco right in here. You'll drive by that aqueduct. You can see it, just in plain sight along the road. And there's another one, a third one that runs up. This is the Sierra Nevada right here. It runs up the east side of the Sierra Nevada. Okay, past, you can see this is a dry lake bed now. It wasn't always. We're going to look at that more closely. It goes all the way up to Mono Lake, which is here. And Mono Lake is just on the east side of Yosemite. So Yosemite is pretty much right about there in the Sierras. Okay. So Los Angeles is pulling in water from far and wide to try and meet demand, right? Let's go ahead and look a little bit more closely at this one right here, which is Mono Lake. And actually, I kind of want to show you where we're at in space. So I'm going to go to the map. Here, I'll bring myself in here again too. Why not? While I'm at it. Okay, here's the map. And now we are in the western United States. Okay, and I'm going to move down to the south here. Here's Arizona. So we were just looking at Phoenix and Tucson, right? The Colorado River comes through here. It defines the border between California and Arizona. Through here goes by Las Vegas, right? Which also needs quite a bit of that water. Okay, it runs through Grand Canyon. And eventually its headwaters head up here through Utah, et cetera, passed over kind of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, end up being its headwaters, all right? But very important river. By the time it gets down here to the Gulf of California, which is right in this area, it really is just a trickle. It is being heavily used, fully accounted for, right? Okay, so now we're in Los Angeles here. I had one, the California Aqueduct going up the Great Valley here. We have the Colorado River being diverted through a aqueduct that comes kind of east-west. And then a third one, which I mentioned, it's going to go up the eastern side of the Sierra here. So let's go ahead and zoom into that. Okay, so here's Los Angeles, right? And that aqueduct, it runs pretty much right up here, right like this, okay? And continues up the east side of the Sierra Nevada, which are these mountains here. You can see Owens Lake. We're going to come back to that in a moment. continues all the way up past Bishop, California, continues over here, and eventually kind of ends up here near Mono Lake, okay? And this is what we're looking at. And you can see Half Dome, Yosemite right over here. If you ever have it, you know, if you're in Yosemite, I don't know, maybe some of you have already done this, but, you know, Yosemite Valley is kind of the popular spot. I find if you take this pass, if it's during the summer, it's open. If you take this pass over the mountains, beautiful drive, number one, and then you pop down the other side of the Sierra, this is such a cool area. It's just desert, and so it's a completely different environment, and it's really beautiful. And Mono Lake is there, and here it is. Check this out. This is pretty interesting, okay? You can see this is the outline, and I don't know if you can see what look like bathtub rings kind of going around the edge, right? Those are bathtub rings. And that's because those are showing previous lake levels, right? This is where the lake used to be at different points in time, okay? And so, in other words, the lake level has gone down quite a bit from where it used to be, all right? Let's go ahead and come back to the slide deck for a minute. So this is pretty much what we were just looking at, right? You can see you have all these beaches here, those lake levels. And, you know, this image here, which actually if I turn on my video for a second, shows some of those historic levels, okay? Shows some of the historic levels. You can see this is 6,372 feet, the historic low. 6,392 is the management level. And then 6,417 is pre-diversion, okay? So this is where it was before Los Angeles came in and started diverting water from this area down towards LA, okay? It used to be up at this sort of light blue level. Right, and it's been as low as here, okay? And the management level is ultimately the level that the federal government is trying to force LA to keep it at. When, you know, that water is valuable. LA doesn't want to. They want the water, but there's a lot of folks, environmentalists and otherwise, that want to keep Mono Lake alive, keep it from drying out. So let's kind of look at what that's looked like. This is Mono Lake surface elevation. And this is what it would have looked like back in the 40s, early 40s, late 30s. Okay, way up here, 6,416. This is that light blue that we were looking at. And then it just started getting drawn down, right? DWP, Department, Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, started drawing things down. And the lake level just went down from 6,400, 6,300 and change, you know, all the way down to a sort of historic lows were right in here. And ultimately, the government stepped in at some point or another and said, hey, you LA, you got to slow it down. We don't want this thing to go completely away. We don't want it to become a dry lake bed. We don't want it to become a playa. Okay, there's, you know, ultimately it provides habitat for all sorts of wildlife, but also it's just nice to have a lake there as opposed to a dry lake bed where you have, and we'll see in a second the problems that that can create if you take something that was formerly a lake and then dry it out. Because it did happen. So ultimately, you know, this is where they want it to be, this dashed line. Okay, that's the mandated level. And this is where it's at. And so we aren't quite there. You know, this is where it's supposed to be. And you can see that the natural changes. I mean, it's not like the lake level doesn't change on its own. Okay, it's a natural system, right? It's going up and down. Depends on climate. Depends on, you know, how much rain fell that year, etc. And you can see that this is kind of a pattern that is reflected down here as well, to some degree, with Los Angeles drawdown kind of superimposed on the top. Okay, so that's Mono Lake. Hopefully it will continue to exist. The same can't be said for Owens Lake, which is this one. So we're looking to the south here. This is the Sierra Nevada. Okay, and then this is to the south. And actually, I think I'm going to pull this guy back in just for a second. Let's go back there really quickly. And we're going to zoom back out so you can kind of see where we are. We're going to head back south here, past Independence. And here it is. That's Owens Lake. Okay, that's what we're just looking at in that image in a bleak view. So we're kind of like that image. The camera is right about here, and it's looking to the south, southwest. Okay, because you see these mountains right in the distance. Okay, but this is Owens Lake. And look at all this interesting kind of development along the edges. Okay, this development, for the most part, this development is being done to mitigate airborne dust. Okay, because there is, you know, a community. There's the community of Lone Pine up here. there was a community down here in Owens Lake itself that's pretty much been minimized since it was dried out. But there is a small community that also exists. You know, you have these small towns. And ultimately, this used to have water in it, okay? L.A. ultimately drained it, right? They pulled the water away and turned it into a permanently dry lake bed. And what that does is, remember, what's at the base of these things? What's at the base of these things is a whole lot of dust, right? And it's shown here in the image, right? It's a whole lot of dust down here. It's mud, right? It's really fine grain material. And once the water goes away, that mud, when the winds start whipping through, that mud can become airborne and turn into dust. And that's exactly what happens in the Owens Lake area. You get these dust storms that come through. The source of that dust coming from this dry lake bed, again, which was made dry by Los Angeles. And that's caused health problems, respiratory problems for people that live in the area. And so there have been a lot of court cases around this for a pretty long time. It's fairly contentious. And, you know, because health problems, of course, are going to be an issue. And so the government has mandated that some sort of mitigation has to occur. And that's what we're seeing here on the edges. Okay, these are places where they're trying to keep them somewhat wet, you know, and doing different engineering practices to ultimately try to hold the dust down, to keep the dust from becoming airborne and causing health problems for nearby communities. So it's a cautionary tale, right? This is why you don't let Mono Lake similarly go to nothing, because you're going to end up with dust problems. And we see this, it happened in Owens Lake. And you can blame, I think you can pretty fairly blame Los Angeles for this. It's a water hungry area. It's a lot of people down there. I lived in Los Angeles myself for a little while. Okay. Guilty as charged. But yeah, I said, these are tricky issues, right? In areas where you don't have a lot of surface water and you're relying on groundwater and or canals bringing in water from elsewhere, water is going to be an issue. That's just basically what it comes down to. So the other thing that Los Angeles is doing, they're also pumping groundwater from this area as well, from these valleys, these relatively arid valleys. They're pumping groundwater and supplementing those canals, right, with this groundwater. And this is an example of one of those, right? And the groundwater exists there. It's being recharged by precipitation in the mountains back here, the Sierra. It was also recharged quite a bit during the last ice age, right, when this was a much wetter area. So there is quite a bit of groundwater down here in the valley, in the subsurface of these valleys, sandstones, mudstones, et cetera. You have good reservoir rocks, and so that's part of it. I mentioned that there's a lot of mitigation trying to keep dust down at Owens Lake. These are some photos from that. They lay down fabric, gravel over the playa sediments to try to decrease the amount of dust that ends up in the air. It's one of the mitigation techniques they're using. You can see these are really interesting features here where they're plowing things into, and you even see people drawing in them, which is pretty funny, plowing things into different patterns, which supposedly helps out. And it ends up becoming art as well, which is kind of cool. You know, there's a lot of sort of creative ways that you can combine, environmental work ultimately with the creative arts. So cool. Okay, and then, you know, the future. I mean, this is, desalinization for places like Los Angeles, large populous areas that are next to the ocean, but don't have enough fresh water, right? They have a freshwater deficit. You know, one possibility, of course, that people are pursuing is desalinization. This also happens in Saudi Arabia and other places that are dry where you have large population centers. The issue with desalinization is it takes a lot of energy, okay? So you're going to need, in these cases, they're using fossil fuels. They're burning fossil fuels to create fresh water from salt water. So it's a whole host of its own problems. In Saudi Arabia, they got plenty of that stuff. They got so much oil, they don't know what to do with it. So, hey, they're running desalinization plants, and they're powering those things with oil. That doesn't bode well for the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, of course. And a lot of issues around this. But basically, when you have a lot of people that are living in relatively dry areas where water is a limited resource, you're going to be having these types of issues. You know, Central Oregon has it. We're blessed, in a sense, to be in the Willamette Valley in Western Oregon. We do have quite a bit of water here. And even with projections of climate change, at least the most recent ones I've seen from some of the modelers at Oregon State University, suggest that the precipitation amount in the Pacific Northwest, west of the Cascades at least, so the Willamette Valley, Puget Sound, et cetera, that precipitation amount is not projected to change much due to climate change. It's going to be warmer, right? And so that means that the type of precipitation is going to change. It's going to go from being more snow, right, in the mountains and such to less snow in the mountains and more liquid precipitation. But the amount of precipitation isn't thought to, isn't projected based on current climate models, et cetera, projected to change much. So lucky us. Okay, I'm going to end there. Again, this is just an introduction to groundwater, and we're going to be talking more about groundwater as we move forward in the class, because groundwater, again, is in addition to being a resource, something useful to humans, it also concentrates minerals, especially in geothermal systems. Okay, so we're going to be coming back to groundwater quite a bit. But I wanted to lay some foundation, especially just understanding how water moves through the subsurface, right? It moves through these pore spaces, assuming you have porosity and permeability in the rock. You know, that permeability can come from connected pore spaces, as we mentioned. It can also come from fractures, okay? And fractures can, you know, are often, most fractures in the rock are naturally occurring. Rock is generally going to be pretty fractured up, even a granite, right, which has very little pore space, is going to have fractures cutting through it. So you do have pathways for fluid to move through all sorts of rock types. Okay, and the way this is going to come into play, just a little preview, is especially in volcanic areas or areas where you have a lot of heat in the subsurface, like the Cascade Mountains. Okay, the Cascades, it's a volcanic chain. Lots of magma under the surface, lots of heat. Okay, you have water that's moving around in there. It's groundwater. May not have much because it's igneous rock down there. In other words, it's that lava rock. Doesn't have porosity, but it has fractures in it still. Okay, so there's still water that's able to move around in the subsurface. And when you have that heat source, what it does, it heats up the water, and that water becomes more buoyant, right? And so it starts wanting to move into shallower levels, potentially, as it's losing its buoyancy. And it wants to be replaced with cooler water that's more dense, okay? So the cool water wants to fall down, go downward, and the hot water wants to move up. And it creates this circulation. It creates convection of groundwater. So groundwater is moving now because you have heat sources. You have other areas further away that are cooler. So the water is going to be circulating from hot to cold and back again, right? And as that water circulating around slowly over geologic timescales, very long timescales, again, in the hot areas, it has a certain pressure temperature regime, and the water is going to be able to hold a certain amount of dissolved solids there. So it might dissolve some of the rock around it. And then it's going to move into the areas that are cooler and potentially lower pressure, right? And as it does so, it's going to start precipitating out certain dissolved solids. Just in the thermodynamics of the system, that water just can't hold it anymore, right? It's just not able to hold some of that stuff anymore. So it starts precipitating out as minerals. And it'll precipitate them out in certain places. And this is why you have things like, you know, a very common example, this would be a quartz vein. Okay, if you go into, you know, you could find these things anywhere, honestly. But if you were in the Sierra Nevada, or if you're in the, you know, even in the Cascade Mountains, which have kind of a little bit of a different rock type there, but you're going to find quartz veins, right, that exist in fractures. It's a very common thing to come across. And that is exactly what's happening. It's fluid that's circulating through the rock in the subsurface, precipitating out that quartz when it hits a certain pressure temperature regime where that quartz can no longer be in solution, right? It needs to come out of solution, precipitate out. Okay, I'm going to talk about that in more detail. Until then, have a good one.